Welcome to the Sadler Lectures podcast. Responding to popular demand, I'm converting my philosophy videos into sound files you can listen to anywhere you can take an MP3. If you like what you hear and want to support my work, go to patreon.com/sadler. I hope you enjoy this lecture. In Rainer Maria Rilke's Letters to a Young Poet, one of the central sets of topics that he picks up and discusses with his interlocutor have to do with sexuality and having sex on the one hand and love on the other, and how these could come together for, at least in our own time and in his own time, some people, and hopefully for everybody in a world yet to come. His picture is in some respects a bit utopian, and he's espousing a very interesting form of feminism, which some would have trouble recognizing as such. And he's telling us that, you know, there's something greater that we can connect ourselves with, but it would take a lot of work, a lot of labor, Arbeit in German, on our part. So he talks about sex and love to his young interlocutor as being difficult tasks. He never actually uses the word task in the German. He says that these are things that are laid upon us, or these that are things that are assigned to us. And this is in letter 5 and letter 7. There is a really important characteristic involved in this. He says, sex is difficult, yes, but those tasks or those things that have been entrusted to us are difficult. Almost anything serious is difficult, and everything is serious. If you just recognize this and manage out of yourself, out of your own talent and nature, out of your own experience and childhood and strength, to achieve, and here he sketches out a bit of the sort of vision for where this is going, a wholly individual relation to sex, one that is not influenced by convention, just a transliteration, convention, and custom, Sitte, then you will no longer have to be afraid of losing yourself and becoming unworthy of your dearest possession. So we have this incredibly important task that is existential in the fact that we all face it so long as we develop to an age where we begin to experience the desires for it. So those of us who make it into puberty and beyond, it is part of our existential condition, and it's not something that we can simply take for granted as a bunch of drives or inclinations. It's something that we're supposed to take on and transform. He also, in letter 7, says it's good to love. Why? Because love is difficult. And then he goes on and he says, for one human being to love another human being, that is perhaps the most difficult task that has been entrusted to us. The ultimate task, the final test and proof, the work, Arbeit, for which all other work is merely preparation. So sex and love, these two fundamental things that are for so many people just separated off, many just don't believe in love at all, Rilke thought these are absolutely central, that they are some of the most important things in our human existence. He goes on and he talks in letter 7 about young people. And he's not engaging in one of those sort of, you know, older person, these young people today, they don't know what they're doing. He's talking about young people throughout the ages. And he's saying they're caught in this tragic situation. I really feel bad for them. Why? Because, he says, young people who are beginners in everything are not yet capable of love, and yet they think they are. They jump into things. And we live in a society where that is highly encouraged, and where love and sex are totally blurred together for them, and also distinguished in ways that are unhealthy as well. So he says it's something they must learn. Why? Loving, he says, does not at first mean, as love songs tell us, merging, surrendering, and uniting with another person. Why? For what, he says, would a union be of two people who are unclarified, unfinished, and still incoherent? Instead, it's, he says, an inducement for the individual to ripen, to become something in himself, to become world in himself for the sake of another person. It's a great demanding claim on him. So if young people really love each other, they have to, in some respect, focus on themselves and their relations to things other than the love object that they want to fuse with, so that they can become a genuine person capable of having and supporting and sustaining that relationship. And that means the other person has to do that too. They can't simply offer themselves to each other and get it on and hope that they're going to have love develop out of that. And he says, this is what young people are so often and so disastrously wrong in doing. They fling themselves at each other when love takes hold of them. They scatter themselves in all their messiness, disorder, bewilderment. And what can happen then? Now notice, Rilke is not saying this to like condemn them or to say, oh, they're so messy, these stupid kids, get off my lawn. No, he's saying this is unfortunate. There's nobody there to give them any helpful guidance about this other than, you know, a bunch of rules. Don't have sex with anybody. You know, be pure. That's not going to be helpful in developing a healthy relationship. He says, what can happen? What can life do with this heap of half-broken things they call their communion, they would like to call their happiness and their future? Each of them loses himself for the sake of the other person and loses the other and many others who still wanted to come. He says, there is no area of life. Seemingly, sexuality is this drive that you know, takes us out of conventions and reveals us as the true selves that we are. He says, that's BS. There is no area of life that is more beset by conventions than sexuality. And that's the way it's always been for us human beings. He says, they escape into one of the many conventions that have been put up in great numbers like public shelters on this most dangerous road. Maybe they're the good people who, you know, just fool around a little bit and wait until they're married. Maybe they're the ones who are breaking all the rules, but they're breaking all the rules in the same way that everybody else is. Maybe they're in the middle of the road somehow. Maybe they're doing their own thing. They find some kink that appeals to them and then read about it on the internet and you know, find some new ways of doing something, but nothing is new. There's only, I mean, one thing, this is a little bit off topic, but one thing that you realize in reading, for example, de Sade's endless discussions of people copulating is there's only so many ways you can put human beings together and make them do things, and it loses its interest very, very quickly. This is an area that is completely beset by conventions, he says. And he tells us that they sense their failure. Many young people who love falsely feel oppressed by their failure. They want to make the situation they've landed in livable and fruitful in their own personal way. Why? Because nature tells them that questions of love cannot be resolved publicly and according to this or that agreement, that they are questions, intimate questions, from one human being to another. Think about sex that way, not as just getting it on, not as something that has become commodified and turned into a million different topics of discussion on everything from blogs to Facebook to pick whatever else you like, but as questions that we're asking each other. And it takes on a very different aspect, doesn't it? He says that when they act out of this mutual helplessness, if with the best of intentions, they try to escape one convention that's approaching them, for example, marriage, they fall into the clutches of some less obvious but just as deadly convention. And he says that even what seems to be, in the ordinary sense, immoral is simply convention. So this is a really important problem. What is he suggesting? Well, he's saying that young people need to learn to develop before they can really get what is available there for us human beings out of sex and out of love. He also talks about sexuality as being shifting in our own time. Now, he's writing around the turn of the last century, in the early 1900s, and so he's seeing some transformations in the Europe of his own time, and we might think today about how far this has been taken and how many steps have gone forward and how many steps have gone back and what this would look like for us in the present. He brings up, for example, this author who he praises, Richard Demel, And he says that, you know, I think his works are really great. You, his interlocutor, have characterized him well with the phrase living and writing in heat. And he says, in fact, the artist's experience lies so unbelievably close to the sexual, to its pain and pleasure, that the two phenomena are really just different forms of one and the same longing and bliss. Instead of heat, one could say sex. Sex in the great, pure sense of the term, free of any sin attached to it by the church. Then his art would be great and infinitely important. But, he says, there's a problem here. What is it? Instead of a completely ripe and pure world of sexuality, what we find in his works is a world that is not human enough, as he says. What does he mean there? Well, this is where we really want to think things through. We are all humans, but in some respects we can be less than human because we don't live up to the potential that we actually have. And some of that, you could say, well, I would be human as a man, and then you're human as whatever gender you are. Rilke goes further than that. He says that this guy's work is not fully human because it's only male. He says, instead of a completely ripe and pure world of sexuality, it finds a world that is only male, is heat, thunder, and restlessness, burdened with the old prejudice and arrogance with which the male has always disfigured and burdened love. Because he loves only as a male and not as a human being, there is something narrow in his sexual feeling, something that seems wild, malicious, time-bound, uneternal, which diminishes his art and makes it ambiguous and doubtful. We certainly, you know, if we're male, we can certainly define ourselves as male, but we have to be more than merely male in relation to the female. And this is something that has been lost on so many people, not just in our own time, but in previous times as well, and it's a danger for the times to come. Rilke goes on to suggest, this is a beautiful phrase, in letter 5, he says, he's talking about beauty of the girl, motherhood, and he says, in the man too there's motherhood, it seems to me, physical and mental. Perhaps the sexes are more akin than people think, and the great renewal of the world, he's sketching out something utopian here, will consist in one phenomenon. So here's a central key view of Rilke's about where sexuality could be going. That man and woman, freed from all mistaken aversions and feelings, will seek each other out not as opposites, but as brothers and sisters, as neighbors, and will unite as human beings in order to bear in common, simply, earnestly, and patiently, the heavy sex that has been laid upon them. He's sketching out here a vision of the future in which we would approach each other not simply as man and woman or whatever other gender relations we may have where we identify primarily with that, but as human beings without losing our sexuality, but in a way so as to view the other person as a fellow worker, not as an adversary, not as a mark for a pickup artist or the female equivalent of that, but as someone to share not just a life with, but labor with, the building of something that can't be done solely on one's own. He goes on and he talks about new possibilities for girls and women in letter 7. And he says, the girl and the woman in their new individual unfolding will be only in passing imitators of male behavior and misbehavior and repeaters of male professions. And I think we've seen lots of that in our own time as waves of feminism have gone through. After the uncertainty of such transitions, it will become obvious that women were going through the abundance and variation of those disguises just so that they could purify their own essential nature and wash out the deforming influences of the other sex. And he says, the humanity of women, carried in her womb through all her suffering and humiliation, will come to light when she is stripped off the conventions of mere femaleness. Femaleness is the opposite of maleness, or that's correlative, or whatever, in the transformation of her outward status, and men who do not feel it approaching will be astonished by it. There will be a reaction by men to this new possibility for living and growing as women, and they can either get with it or they can go against it, but they will eventually be left behind. He says, this advance, at first very much against the will of the outdistanced men, will transform the love experience. And that's another fundamental key point, what sex and love actually could be. And here we get to one of Rilke's definitions of what genuine love ought to be. He says, the love experience, which is now filled with error, will be changed from the ground up and reshaped into a relationship that is meant to be between one human being and another, no longer one that flows from man to woman. So there won't be that unidirectionality anymore. And he says, this more human love, which will fulfill itself with infinite consideration and gentleness and kindness and clarity and binding and releasing, will resemble what we're now preparing painfully and with great struggle, the love that consists in this. So here's the characterization of love, that two solitudes protect and border and greet each other, two Einsamkeiten. Solitude is something absolutely central to the fully developing human being for Rilke. It's what's needed for the younger people to be able to develop. The last thing that I'll point out is that Rilke says that this transformation is yet to come, but those in the present who are solitary, who are developing themselves, can prepare the way for this in the way that they live, and that would extend to their own love and sexual relations. Special thanks to all of my Patreon supporters for making this podcast possible. You can find me on Twitter at Philosopher70, on YouTube at the Gregory B. Sadler channel, and on Facebook on the Gregory B. Sadler page. Once again, to support my work, go to patreon.com/Sadler. Above all, keep studying these great philosophical works.